Lands of Am, 104.4.
The first radio. It was a box with a cat's whiskers. Well, it's a little glass tube on top of a box, and to get the station, you had to twiddle a wire on this end here against a crystal in there, and that would change the station. But there was always a fight, because everybody wanted, there was only one set of earphones.
This is Resonance 104.4 FM. Welcome to the bike show. My name's Jack Thurston, and believe it or not, this is the 200th edition of The Bike Show, the weekly half hour on matters bicycling that has been gracing the airwaves of Resonance FM since 2004. And as befits a landmark edition, I'm delighted that this week we have the first of a two-part interview with a man who is something of a legend. His name is Mike Burrows, and he's one of the world's greatest bicycle designers. It's possible that you've not heard of Mike, though you may well recognise one of his inventions, the slick and aerodynamic jet black carbon fibre machine that Chris Boardman rode on the track to win a gold medal at the Barcelona Olympics. That was the first time in over 70 years that a British cyclist had won an Olympic gold, and it could go down as the moment that began the revival of British cycle sport that we continue to witness today. If you ride a road bike that's less than 15 years old, then there's a very good chance that it's essentially a Mike Burrows creation too, the compact road frame. For all his contributions to the conventional upright bicycle, it's the laid-back or recumbent bicycle for which Mike has the greatest passion, and that'll be the subject of next week's show. But this week, Mike talks about how he first got into cycling, his work with Lotus, Chris Boardman and Giant, about his tussles with the sport's governing bodies and what he believes to be a deeply conservative bicycle industry. Entirely self-taught as an engineer, you could say that Mike Burrows is a natural.
I could just pick up bits of metal, you know, just have an intuitive feel for engineering. Not electronics. The moment you get to the sort of the circuit, then there's something about the human brain. It doesn't seem to encompass both terribly well. But I can handle anything mechanical, really, quite simply. Not saying I could design Boeings tomorrow. You get a little bit sophisticated at that level. But the bicycle I can encompass in totality, and I can see the whole picture. And I've never been trained. I've never been educated. But I've clearly been genetically produced to be an engineer.
Looking back at your childhood, was that something that you remember from being a child?
My father had been a cabinet maker and engineer and worked at De Havilland Aircraft Company. You know, I was just cutting up blocks of balsa wood when I was 3 and 4 years old with a penknife and making little things with them, and I sort of migrated that way. And as a hobby, I'd always done stuff with my hands, model aeroplanes, trains, that sort of thing. And aero modelling is very good because you encompass everything. You design, you build, you fly, you know, whatever. And you can be as innovative as you like because you're not going to die because it's only a model aeroplane sort of thing. And then that's it. So that taught me to stretch my mind. I eventually got into cycling because another motoring event, the car blew up and I had to cycle to work and back. This was in my 30s. All of a sudden sort of thing, and sort of quite liked it. You know, I had cycled as a kid, but never as an adult. I'd never been a racing cyclist, but there in my 30s, I was cycling to work and back, and this was very enjoyable. And by then, I had a friend who had made his own frame. And this affair, wow, you made a bicycle frame, and not thinking of it as engineering. In the world of cycling, this is sort of very much a black art, you know. And he said, well, no, it's just, you know, you can braise, can't you? I've done more brazing in engineering than you could imagine. So, yeah, so I made my first frame and then slowly got into making them for a couple of friends and things. And then Brighton 1980 came along, the HPV Championships. Went to see that, and that just opened not just my eyes, a lot of people's eyes, I think. Suddenly here were people going at 50 miles an hour, laid on their back in streamlined covers, and they were sort of bicycles, but they were and they weren't. So I started designing those in parallel to the cycling side.
So I'm curious about why, having cycled as a child, as many children do, you didn't continue on, you know, just as an everyday cyclist as a teenager. Was it the times that people weren't cycling?
It wasn't a thing. This was, of course, in the 50s, which was the heyday of cycling for the working classes, but the only time the working classes ever did ride bicycles. But I wasn't interested in the bicycle, and I was riding bicycles in aero. I used them to chase the models when you flew free flight. But my first cycling injury involved chasing a model airplane. But the idea of it, I didn't need it as transport. I mean, my father had a business, so I was obviously eventually... That took a long time to pass my driving test. I wasn't into cars. There was no Jeremy Clarkson at that time sort of thing. I eventually did become a Jeremy Clarkson, it has to be said. Just, there was no reason to ride a bicycle, especially, or take any interest in the bicycle, you know. It wasn't that thing. So I would say it was aero modelling, then cars and women and, you know, all the usual things. And then only when I had to sort of get on a bike, and possibly because I was old enough to appreciate it. You know, when you're young, maybe you don't appreciate how nice a bicycle is, sort of thing.
What did you appreciate about it?
Just coming out of the factory, having had a bad day with the foreman, and just suddenly not being stuck in a traffic jam, and the freedom to sort of, you know, shoot off down the road sort of thing. Wonderful sensation. Being in control. You know, you're completely in charge of the bicycle sort of thing. It's really nice, incredibly satisfying. A lot of people, their sensitivity is not subtle enough to realise. We're bombarded with so many big, shiny, glossy things, and hey, this will make you happy, and this, that, and the other. And, you know, so we're constantly looking for things when the real happiness is actually sort of there in front of us. I mean, these days I'm a keen bird watcher as well, so just walking around quiet country lanes and listening for birds, which, as a youngster, you know, I wouldn't have done. Teenagers don't do things like that by and large, sort of thing. But it's, I'm in my 60s, it's taken me a while to mature, sort of thing. But I recommend maturing a bit quicker to most people. You get more out of life, sort of thing. And cycling's part of that subtle end of the spectrum. You know, it's never going to be big, shiny, glossy, sort of wham-bam, in-your-face stuff, whatever. You know, there aren't going to be the Jeremy Clarksons of the cycling world.
So you're riding the bicycle, you're an engineer, you've been toying with balsa wood since the age of three, it's in your blood. What are your earliest observations about the bike that you're riding and how it might be improved?
I've never tried to improve the bicycle per se. I've never looked at the bicycle and thought, oh, that's terrible, I'll set about improving it, which more people have done than anything else on the planet. I mean, it really has been attacked from all sides. I just fell in love with the bicycle, and as an engineer I've always liked efficiency, and clearly nothing is more efficient than the bicycle. It's a wonderful device. I just started reproducing them. My first frames were just copies of other frames, and it was only when the human-paired vehicle kicked off, the laid-back, and suddenly you stop thinking that the way to improve a bicycle was by, you know, tight clearances, head angles and things. Obviously none of those affect the speed of a bicycle, sort of thing. And we were designing streamliners by then, and we understood it was, as I knew from aerobonding, of course, it's about aerodynamics, stupid. That's really all it is.
I think it's a bit of a mystery for a lot of people who don't know much about science and aerodynamics and physics, why the aerodynamics is dominant in speed. Can you put a teacher's hat on for a moment, and can you explain why it's the aerodynamics, stupid?
Yeah, I mean, I can explain it, and you can, everyone can go out and test it for themselves. They've done it all the time, they just haven't thought about it. There's a resistance to everything, okay? So when you start pedalling a bicycle, you are pushing the air out of the way, you are turning lots of little bearings around inside, and you're squashing the tyres at the bottom. But 30 mile an hour with no wind and no hill, 90% of your resistance, roughly, is aerodynamic drag. Because you and your bicycle are a very bad shape, okay? You're not evolved from an albatross, but from a monkey or something like a monkey. And the bicycle, much the same. Rolling resistance is the next thing, roughly 7%. And total mechanical drag of all the little wiggly bits that go around is about 3%. Now, as you go faster, the resistance increases. But mechanical resistance and rolling resistance rise linear. So in other words, if you double your speed, there's twice as much rolling resistance, twice as much mechanical drag. Air resistance doesn't do this. Now, why it doesn't, I don't know. It's to do with physics, but it doesn't. Air resistance goes up by the square. So to go, if you go twice as fast, you will have four times as much air resistance. And it's even worse because the energy required to overcome it goes up by the cube. So to go twice as fast, eight times the power. Now, you can experience this any time you like. You ride into a headwind. It feels like a brick wall. It is a brick wall. You're not going to do anything about it at all other than getting inside the streamlined enclosure. That's it.
But we can't see it. I mean, this is the big mystery. We can't see this air stuff. You know, what is it? There are atoms there in a gas, and they weigh something, do they? I mean, and you've got to push them out of the way.
It's stuff. The reason we can't see it is because goldfish can't taste water. We're in it. If you stand outside it, you can see it. If you're sitting on the moon, you can see the atmosphere is bleeding thick compared to not atmosphere. Very, very thick. Yeah, it's stuff. It's like water, but 800 times thinner.
We'll come to the laid-back bikes and the stuff that you're doing this year. But I want to talk about the work that you've done on the traditional upright type of bicycle.
The classic bicycle, the
bicycle of the 19th century, the late 19th century. Because of the amount of publicity that it got, the Lotus machine that Chris Boardman rode to world records and Olympic success, that's probably the bicycle that you're most famous for. Tell us that story about coming up with that design.
Most things, like the origin of the original Von Dries bike, we don't know where they started, but I know exactly, because I built this little baby frame bicycle, so a 16-inch frame, great long aero seat post, you know, common these days, no one had ever done that then. And I was riding around on that, and a friend of mine, Simon Sanderson, who lives up on the North Coast, had got his hands on some carbon fibre. And I saw this stuff, and it's just this, wow, you know, ooh, what can I make with this? It's really strong and light sort of thing. Ooh, ah. And I went away and realised that this little baby frame I had, I was riding a 16-inch bicycle, okay, not a 23-inch, which I had been before. You could fill it in. Hey, you could fill that in. It could be solid. And that was that first realisation that if I filled that frame in, made the frame in effect solid, you know, I could then mould it in as a hollow carbon fibre structure. I knew what a monocoque was that we got from the world of, say, aeroplane, they're monocoques, sort of thing. And obviously the aerodynamic benefits. You just lost all of those stupid tubes and made one beautiful carbon fibre, big, fat, streamlined tube. So, no, that the principle was fine. Putting it into practice really wasn't quite as easy. And so we managed to buy some ourselves. And then no end of trouble getting it moulded. Eventually got it finished, and actually that was ridden May Day 1984, which is quite nice, being a revolutionary bicycle. I thought, right, that's it, I've changed the world. And I took it around the bike shows and showed everybody, and no one took any notice at all. They would say, why have you covered the tubes up? No, I haven't covered them up. Like, this is a big tube, it's the shape of a bicycle. No, absolutely just ignored from one end to the other. Nobody wanted to know. And it was years later by which time I was in effect onto Mark III, because that first bike had a pair of forks on the front and it had the wheel in the slot at the back in a relatively conventional way. The first thing I was invited by John Pinkham and the Veteran Cycle Club to take part in the celebration of the safety bicycle. It was not 1885, the Rover safety was promoted, not the first safety bike, but it was the one that mattered. We recreated the ride in 1985, and there was a load of very old Rovers or solid tyred safety bicycles, and me on a carbon fibre monocoque. Who said it's not about the bike? We cycled all the way from Peterborough to Birmingham via Coventry Transport Museum, where I shall be later in the year giving a talk. And there they had the Invincible, Surrey Machinist Company, 1888, I think one of them was, monoblade front and rear. And most people see this and think, well, that's a bit funny, why has it only got one fork leg and that? But as an aero modeler, I understood the difference between monoblades and planes and biplanes. Biplanes, very bad and slow. Monoplanes, very fast, because the drag between two things is more than the drag of the two things. I realised that mounting the wheel in a slot was rather conventional thinking, and that wasn't the way you used carbon fibre. It made much more sense to have the wheel one side, the chain the other. Offset wheels really don't matter. It doesn't matter if they line up. It's all like going in the same direction. And again, just ignored by everybody, except a young man called Rudy Toman, who is French. He was a bit of a cyclist, but basically he was a test driver for Lotus. And he saw the bike hanging up at work and asked what it was. I explained and whatever, because we'd cycled together, but he'd never seen me doing that sort of stuff. And he took it into Lotus to show them this. And that was his project, really. I mean, I was off again doing laid-back stuff by then and given up on the bike. And Rudy was the one that pushed it through Lotus and, right, we'll get this project up and running. I obviously knew Chris would be riding the Pursuit, so I contacted Chris and people about, you know, would you like Lotus to build you a bicycle sort of thing. And the rest is, as they say, just history, whatever sort of thing.
Then there was a backlash against this innovation in design of bicycles for the track.
No one had really spotted what was going to happen in terms of the media coverage. The papers, the media, focused on the bicycle, you know, because obviously that was news. No one had built a bicycle like that, and it was Lotus, who was a Formula One company, you had a mad professor and a clean young athlete. It was a brilliant story. But the cycling world is only used to athletes. No one since, you know, that Rover ride in 1885 had ever said, look, here's a better bicycle. And they really resented it to this day, you know. Lotus couldn't understand it because they were used to winning things like Formula One races. And no one there ever said, oh, was it the driver or the car? you know, it was a team. You'd need a good driver and you need a good car. And the same with the Olympics. You need good riders and good bikes. But if you look these days, no one's even allowed to mention the bicycles. They just got so paranoid over the whole thing. And this, I think, is a terrible shame, because that image of the bicycle being new and modern, I think, did more to help put people on bicycles than anyone with bulgy muscles ever did. I mean, it's good for Britain that, you know, our cyclists are these days so fabulously good on the track, sort of thing. It's superb for the sport. I don't think it encourages many non-cyclists to look at the bicycle as a solution to their problems. Whereas if you change the image of the bicycle, I think that helps enormously. People sort of revisit the bike. Oh, look, the bicycle's moved on since I was a kid, sort of approach. And I think that there's three ways you get people on bicycles. One is with the government providing better facilities, and clearly we're falling well short there. Two is the industry providing better bicycles, and they're not doing terribly well there. The chain case designs I was working on haven't really emerged yet. And the other is the sport. The bicycle is the one piece of sporting equipment that's got more of a role to play outside the arena than inside. You know, tennis rackets, cricket bats, footballs, useless outside the arena. Bicycle saves the planet. Every time someone gets out of a motor car and onto a bicycle, the world becomes a better place and they become a better person. That's absolutely established scientific fact. Everyone should be working towards getting more people on bicycles and out of their motor cars. Good for everybody.
So what are your feelings towards the UCI?
Having worked for Giant, you know, the world's biggest bike maker, I've been sat down at dinners next to some quite important people, including the technical people of the UCI. And they're not evil and they're not corrupt. There's not enough money in cycling for corruption to make any sense. They just don't have a clue. They really don't know what the problem is. They don't know what they should be doing. So they're trying to hang on to something that they think they've got, because they might lose it. But they haven't. The sport itself doesn't have a problem. The sport's fine. It's very healthy. It doesn't know. It's this cycling in the outside world, and that's what they should be doing. They should be promoting the bicycle as newer and more modern, and not being obsessed with it only being the athlete who should win the event. It shouldn't. It's a cycle race. A cycle race involves cycles, you know, and that's a part of the equation, in the same way that sailing races involve sailing boats. Now, if you want a class for third world countries that everyone can afford the same, which they have in sailing. If you're into sailing, the Finn is the Olympic monotype that's supplied by the Olympics. Companies like Giant would be happy to give the Olympics as many bicycles as they want, okay? No problem, because they have their names on the down tube. So you can have a monotype if you want. If you want to have sort of an Olympic class for the affordable bicycle, that can be dropped into place really quite easily. But the bicycle's not expensive. Even the shiniest carbon toy in the world is well affordable, sort of thing. And developing, you know, the better stuff. You need rules. We don't want anarchy. I mean, obviously, even the laid-back world has rules, sort of thing. But something like one of our part-fared laid-back races, the low races, in things like the prologue of the Tour de France, you know, where individual riders go, that would really lift everything wonderfully. It really would.
Don't you think there's a valid critique of science and engineering that they're always looking for the next new thing, but the next new thing is not always an improvement when taken in totality? And maybe the bicycle as it was conceived by the John Starleys and of the 1880s, that's good enough. You know, that was pretty optimum. That was a platonic form which doesn't need to be tweaked with. What are you doing? Why are you adding all this extra complexity to something that is essentially good enough?
Well, but in terms of function, yes, it's very hard to fault the bicycle other than its aerodynamics and the biomechanics, the ergonomics, the whole thing is very, very efficient. But it lacks rather a lot in marketing. So it is Victorian, that's its primary. But of course, whilst you can't improve the absolute performance of the bicycle in terms of speed across the road, you can improve massively its day-to-day performance, the maintenance, the ongoing, the whatever. If you actually use a bicycle on a day-to-day basis, what are the consequences of the prices? And one of the things I was promoting was the idea of structural chain cases. The Dutch bicycles all have chain cases to protect you from the chain. But then when you get a puncture, you can't get the wheel out. It's a real pain. So what you have is the chain case, but no bicycle. So the wheel is on one side. The gears are all inside a chain case, which stays clean and oily, and you stay clean and not oily. And if you get a puncture, you can just pop the tire off one side. Now, all of that is sort of technological development that needs promoting and funding, and racing is a very good way of doing it. My current monocoque classic bike, as it were, that is a structural chain case. It's the fastest bicycle in the world. It's just phenomenal performance.
So let me get this right. There's a chain case which is serving two functions. to keep the chain surrounded and keep it out of the way, but also to support the rear wheel as the chain stays would do in a classic bike.
The pioneers of this were famously Lambretta and Vespa, the scooters of the 50s and 60s. They had a wheel on one side of the back, so you could change the wheel if you got a puncture.
You can replace the inner tube without having to take the wheel off the bicycle and deal with all that.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about your work with Giant. You created a bicycle which we see in its form, not necessarily made by Giant anymore, but we see it everywhere, the compact frame. Where did that come from?
Road bike sales at that time, it was 94, were really quite low. Mountain bikes dominated, 90% was mountain. And they'd got the all-carbon fibre mountain bike frame, what Trek called the OCLV technology, which Giant were using, moulded lug, moulded tube. But to go to road, they needed 10 sets of tooling, because of the 8, 10 different sizes of frame you needed, sort of thing, to cope with road bikes, and sales were very, very low. So the manufacturing company in Taiwan was saying to the sales company in Europe, no, you know, we're not going to tool up for that. It'll cost us tens of thousands of pounds, hundreds of thousands, and you won't sell enough bicycles to justify it. So I was sort of sitting in on these conversations, and I hadn't even got the job then. And I realised, well, actually, I'd made this little 16-inch time trial frame all these years ago, and that was sort of fine. And I'd ended up with a Fisher Mount Tam, 16-inch mountain bike. And that was sort of quite nice. And I thought, hang on, could I have a 16-inch road bike? I normally rode a 23-inch, something like that. So I got them to send me out one of their scrap mountain bike frames, 16-inch one, and I built that up as a road bike, long arrow seat post, a road fork, which corrected the head angle slightly, rode it out to the annual Beano in the Netherlands, Lelystad, in 94, and said, well, look, I sort of come up with this, what do you think? Oh, what is it? Well, I don't really know it. Sort of, yes, the idea is maybe you could make three sizes of road bike, like we do a mountain bike, but you'd have a whole series of aero seat posts. They'd be in different lengths, and I'd come up with an adjustable handlebar stem. Bearing in mind, this was 94, nobody would have been seen dead riding a road bike with an A head stem on it. They were an obscenity, okay? Mountain bikes had A head stems, not road bikes. Road bikes had Cinelli 1As on, and that was all. So I did something that looked a bit like a Cinelli 1A, but was adjustable. So you could then change stem length and seat post length for the customer in the shop, and you would customise the bike at point of sale, which is a good from Giant's point of view. You build a customer-dealer relationship. You've got a smaller, slightly more aerodynamic frame, and slightly stiffer. This is more evolution than revolution, but as you slope that top tube down, you get better torsional stiffness for any given weight of material, and you gain a bit of vertical compliance, which is quite useful. Bikes are obviously two-dimensional objects, very rigid. But that all sort of came about through discussions and meetings, and it evolved, and they then made some prototypes in aluminium. And the boss of Giant Europe, Jan Dirksen, was a keen racing cyclist in his day. He had one built for him. And everyone just fell in love with them, and that was it. But it was almost as if the competitors understood what we'd got before Giant did, in a way. So I think they weren't used to being leaders. These are time of leaders, and nothing against them. They're brilliant engineers, but they weren't used to leading the way. And suddenly the Italians were copying the Taiwanese, which is a very sort of strange effect to have.
And so what was the UCI's reaction to this latest innovation of yours?
They wanted to bat it like everything else. It came under the Lugano declaration of January 2000. Everything that Mike Burrows did is banned, basically, sort of thing. The monocoques, all of that, and the sloping top tube. They wanted to ban sloping top tubes or limit them to a very shallow angle or something, whatever. And this is why I was sat down next to their technical man in Donostia to have a chat with him, but to no avail. And there was no official channel to get to the UCI. There was no contact between the UCI and the industry. There's no such channel. It does not exist. Everyone was complaining about all sorts of things, and Giant weren't too bothered about the monocoque. That wasn't making any money for them, although it's because their marketing people didn't understand the potential. But the compact road was making serious money. It was the best thing they'd ever done, of course. Luckily, the boss of Giant Europe, say Jan Dirksen, was a famous Dutch racing cyclist and I think speed skater in his day, and of course Verbruggen, the boss of the UCI, is a Dutchman. So Jan was able to just basically give him a ring, can I come round and have a chat, and basically point out, well, look, the three sizes only makes the bike cheaper and better, all the rest of it, isn't that sort of what you're trying to promote? Basically, it couldn't say no. So it was just through the old Pals Act, in a sense, that we actually got compact road saved.
And what about reaction of everyday racing cyclists, clubmen, used to the horizontal top tube? What do they think of the new compact form?
Curiously, the first to see it were Onthe. It was our Spanish agent approached Onthe and said, look, you know, would you like to ride giant bikes? Because we weren't strong in Spain at all. We took Compact Road out there and we took the classic bikes. They were riding Look, I think, at the time, who did the same carbon tube, aluminium lug that Giant were doing for their classic range. And said, look, explain the theory behind it, smaller, lighter, we can custom them a little bit, whatever. Or if you prefer, you can ride the existing bikes, whatever. And they said, no, you know, they look a bit strange, you know, but we understand where you're going. Send us a few out to try out. So we did. And the riders fell in love with them. There was a sort of X factor. You got on a little tiny frame and it sort of felt nice. No one ever really worked out what it was, but that's it. So everyone who sort of rode them just sort of fell in love with them. And that was it. We were away sort of thing. But, yeah, there are still people who... they like the Eddie Merckx look, as it were, sort of thing, and there'll always be that. But in functional terms, it's a better bicycle. But it's evolutionary, not revolutionary. The cycling world is desperately conservative. If you look, it's really very, very slow to change for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, the reason I left Giant was the UCI banning everything I did. But that attitude permeates throughout industry. And it's not entirely, but it's partly to do with the Shimano effect, the Shimano dominate. When I was with Giant, I thought, right, I'm with Giant, the world's biggest bike makers. We will tell Shimano what to do. No, you don't. What happens is Shimano send you their list of parts, the same as everyone else, and you make your bikes fit them. Now, this is like Lucas sending headlight drawings to Ford and saying, like, we're going square next year. You need to make your body shells fit. And that's it. That is the bike industry is run like that. There is no innovation channel available. So you get into a way of thinking that involves changing colour and graphics and waiting to see what Shimano do. Now, yeah, Shimano do very nice things. But Shimano aren't going to bring out the monoblade tomorrow. And they're not going to bring out enclosed chain case with gears inside tomorrow sort of thing. You know, they might well have designed them, but they're just sort of sitting on them if they are. Sensible oversized bottom brackets haven't come in yet. You want a bottom bracket size that reflects the fact that down tubes are now bigger than the bottom bracket shell. It's much easier to, you know, weld a big one in. So that whole industry is sort of holding itself back. I don't think it knows why. There are other companies. You've got SRAM competing out there. You've still got Campagnolo going, whatever. They've all just dropped in line, in a sense, whatever, with Shimano. Shimano don't sort of do it on purpose. Shimano aren't deliberately, obviously they're trying to sell as much as they can, but they're not trying to stop progress or development. They've just got a system that sort of works, and it just rolls on like that, and everyone's happy to go with it. And at every level, you've got cyclists who are, by their nature, a bit conservative and sort of, you know, quite slow to change. You've got the industry, I say, because it's sort of a big snowball and rolling on, and there isn't a lot of money to be made in cycling, so you're not going to get the best brains. You know, we know there's a big magnet down the road. It's called the city. They all get sucked in there, which is why we've got crap industry in this country. And the cycling world is almost the opposite. It's an anti-magnet. It's pushing people out, so you're never getting the very top brains dragged into cycling. And you've got the media. The cycling magazines are appalling today. They're just so conservative, you know, right rubbish. They always have written drivel about comfortable frames and this and the other and all the garbage because their customers want to read it. They don't want me to tell them the truth. They hate it. And that's all of that combined. So to get into that and change that, it's very hard.
Tell me about your process for innovation and invention. I gather that you don't use computerized modelling tools. You don't even have email at your workshop.
No, I'm really lucky, and in years to come people will look back and say what a pioneer I was, but no, I sit in front of the television, bored out of my skull, and drool, basically. I've got pages and pages of droodles. I mean, on a par with Leonardo there, although no enigmatic ladies as yet, sort of thing. It starts there. It starts with little sketches on bits of paper, ideas, things have triggered it off. And that was one of the nice things working for Giant. I was flying around the world being famous, doing bike shows and all sorts of things, and that's where your inspiration comes from. And I then basically go to work and I pick up bits of metal and see if I can make the piece of paper droodle, you know, in metal and will it work, sort of thing. And so it goes on. But at the moment, obviously, I'm working just for myself, so it's at times slightly frustrating because I can design more than I will want to make for myself, as it were. I'm not a big commercial business, as it were.
Have you been savvy on the commercial side of things? Have you got patents out there that are bringing in the millions?
No, why would I want that? No, money doesn't make you happy, can't make you happy. So I'm just, yeah, I'm, you know, I am happy, and I know I can't be any happier with money, so it's never bothered me. I mean, Giant paid me a good wage. I didn't get royalties in anything because we agreed that. They just paid me a very nice salary, whatever, and that was fine, but these days I don't even pay income tax, and that's nothing to do with the Cayman Islands or clever accountants, because I don't earn enough money to pay income tax or whatever. But it's fine. I'm just as happy as I was with Giant whizzing around the world with my gold card and all expenses sort of thing, and buying Prada and stuff. But that's what people need to understand, is happiness is nothing to do with money whatsoever.
That was Mike Burrows, and we'll hear more from him next week on The Bike Show. As I said, this is the 200th edition of The Bike Show. Thank you to all the guests who've been on the show, giving their time, all the guest contributors, people who've produced features for the show. If you've got in touch and suggested a feature for the show, thank you. Keep them coming. If you've helped keep the show on air by donating to Resonance FM, thank you. If you've helped spread the word by producing a review of the show, thank you. But thanks most of all for listening. This show is for you, the listeners. It's been enormous fun for me. See you next week.